diferente do que se fez nos últimos dias, porque falhava um domínio assim. Por fim, doncs, comencem. Stephen Joseph McNulty, Brissan Change, Linguicide, deixa-me dizer que eu tenho sucesso, perdão. Linguicide and Image Planning for One Installation House in France. Vou ler, por exemplo, só para alguns alguns.
Bom dia, senhores e senhoras, e muitas graças a todos que estão aqui e por haver me invitado a compartilhar uma conversa com vocês aqui. Antes de começar, eu queria explicar que fazia esta apresentação em inglês. Estaria muito contente de acertar perguntas em catalão, castelhano e francês também durante a convidada. So it's English. I have one of the most difficult accents in all English language, so bear with me. My name is Steve Middleton, and I'm a student at the University of Edinburgh. I'm undertaking a PhD related to language policies and the receptions and interpretations by young people in Catalonia and all. Today, I'll be presenting some meta-theoretical work that I covered in my master's dissertation last year regarding the themes of linguicide and linguistic suicide, before then discussing the case of regional languages in France. So, depending on the perspective that you take, France has had only one official language since 1992, when it is explicitly made so by constitutional amendments, or since 1539, and the passage of the Ordonnance de la Liberté, which made the use of the French language, or as some have argued, a French language, compulsory in public administration. In spite of this, as many who do not study the French context specifically, especially some, a lot of people who say in academia, often do not realize, France is positively swimming in linguistic diversity, and indeed, a 1998 survey revealed the existence of 75 different linguistic varieties spoken within metropolitan France and its overseas territories, including 10 non-linguistic content indigenous to mainland France, on which this paper will focus. So none of these languages possesses any official status, although some of them have been subject of some language policies, particularly language and education policies. And as some of you may know already, it is notoriously difficult to assess linguistic vitality in France, given that official censuses largely omit questions about linguistic competence for ideological reasons. However, if we compare the results of the Lake Wales 1794 survey, which reveals that approximately half of the French population were unable to speak French, with a 2011 survey which found that only 0.6% of respondents use a written language in their day-to-day life, an extreme large-scale shift becomes apparent. And these findings at the outset of my study led me to form the following very basic questions. How does such a dramatic decline of languages so widely spoken come about? How is such language decline and death conceptualized within the current academic literature? Is there a framework that can be used to describe or explain this process within one being constructed? And how can it be applied to the French context? And in particular, I was interested in the role played by language policy in this process. And I pause just for a moment to talk about my conceptualization of language policy. Departing from traditional definitions, I conceptualize language policy in a way that most closely aligns with Barthes and Hunger as well as Spolsky's definitions. Accordingly, I view language policy primarily as discourse, as ideologies or beliefs about languages and their speakers, whether in concretized or written form, or in spoken form, or even left unsaid. In particular, I subscribe to Spolsky's term of language management as being a tool that can be used to encourage modifications in language beliefs found to be deficient in some way. And Hergé's discussion of image planning also seems to complement Spolsky's model of language policy by shedding light on the interlink between its language management and language belief components. According to him, the identity of a particular community is a fact, but the image that the community has of itself or that others have of it is subject to manipulation, whether for the better or for the worse, and this can be achieved through targeted language planning. Language policy is also a positive to play a significant role in determining the ultimate fate of languages. So my initial findings regarding the conceptualization of language decline and death in the current academic literature revealed more conflict than consensus, and this is distinctly summed up in Spolsky's quote here, who says that the loss of linguistic diversity results less from linguistic genocide than from linguistic suicide. And this quotation is representative of a rather long-standing division of perspectives in the academic community, as well as among non-academics, regarding the demise of languages without the death of their speakers. Do languages such decisions as being pragmatic. Speakers are said to recognize the incompatibility of their mother tongue with the demands of the modern world, and to acknowledge, as George Joseph in 2014 put it, an economic and linguistic reality. The majority of languages seem to be a vehicle for socio-economic advancement, and thus speakers need conscious decisions to embrace it. For this reason, academics such as Vlad Fogel will argue that language revitalization efforts are totally unnecessary, unnatural, or even unjust. And similar views have also been expressed outside of academic media, and some examples of this which I can share with you later. If speakers appear to make an unquenched decision for their socio-economic betterment, then why should we actually intervene? Advocates of the linguistic paradigm posit that speakers cannot possibly possess agency over language shift, and to assert should be placing blame on victims. According to authors such as May, 2015, if any choice does exist, it will most often only can be seen as a forced choice, particularly if the majority of the language has already become the de facto official language of most domains of society, and even more so, speakers face persecution for using their native language outside of their own. The focus of the linguistic paradigm, therefore, is placed on an external agent, whether structural or ideological, who attempts to kill a language. Scudder, Kenyon, and Phillipson, who are perhaps best associated with the concept of linguistic, assert that it can be carried out either actively or overtly, directly, relying on explicit legal or discursive repression of a language, and passively or covertly involving a lack of intervention or more ideological means, what Howard Scudder kind of called the colonization of the mind. And Hassan Borenthal provides a nice, useful tripartite conceptual model of active linguistics in their worldview of the attempted eradication of the Kurdish language in Turkey, comprised of criminalization, dialectization, and de-intellectualization. With regard to passive linguistics, Scudder, Kings, and Phillipson assert that this may constitute either letting the language die or unsupported coexistence, which could be summed up using Kulikin Patton's term benign neglect. However, if passive linguistics relies on ideological means, I would argue that this definition could be extended to incorporate the concepts of folklorization, which I think was mentioned by Audrey Boyer in the other day, as well as marginalization used by May 2013. And these will be explained a little bit further in relation to some examples later. So in summary, it's through these means that external agents are said to force or invoke undesired language shift. So where does agency lie? Does it lie with external forces or with speakers? Where should we place the blame, so to speak? Linguistic and linguistic suicide are frequently presented as opposing perspectives up until the present day. Some researchers have attempted to reconcile these two viewpoints, stating that both external and internal forces are simultaneously at play. Edwards in 1985, for example, stated that in linguistic suicide there is always a murderer. And along these lines, I would like to suggest that this is the case, and it is impossible to consider either viewpoint independent of the other. On the one hand, it's virtually impossible to physically prevent someone from using a language, and therefore that speakers possess a degree of agency in language shift seems somewhat axiomatic. In addition, we can't patronize speakers by assuming that they can't make decisions for their own welfare. However, it must be noted that the assessments that speakers allegedly conduct of their social linguistic environment prior to shifting language are frequently based on conditions under the control of external agencies, such as the rights that they're afforded and public discourse surrounding their languages. If these conditions and discourses convey the message, intentionally or unintentionally, that their languages are inferior or useless in some way, it's understandable that speakers will respond by shifting. So I would posit that linguistic always occurs through ideological reasons, whether through direct, intentionally targeting discourse, or even indirect, even unintentionally negative discourse, which portrays languages as inferior or useless in some way. The elements that we considered may be understood as linguistic images, which are conveyed in language policy discourses. These images are then internalized by minority language speakers, becoming part of their habitus or their historical body or mental model, depending on which you prefer. Intergenerational transmission also transmits these linguistic images, leading over time to speakers becoming convinced of the inferiority of their minoritized language through what Sullivan referred to as a gradual attitude shift. And finally, under the influence of these changed attitudes, speakers then take the decision to cease the intergenerational transmission process, thereby committing linguistic suicide. Nothing revolutionary, but in this view, therefore, linguistic and linguistic suicide are seen as necessarily independent, and neither should be considered without the other. It's thus the task of language revitalization to reverse this process. So having established this theoretical basis, when I proceed to examine some examples of what's processed in France. And adopting this perspective, one may split France's history in terms of language policy into roughly four phases. So an active linguistic phase, passive linguistic, and then one which is a little bit questionable, which is the jury is out to say in English. And then this period will focus on phase two, three, and four. So France's period of active linguistic is posited to coincide with the French Revolution of the 18th century, a time when France was, in essence, a linguistically, socially divided country. The revolutionaries possessed a desire to elevate all French people to the same social level and to create equality by eliminating divisions. The French language, therefore, was seen as a tool to accomplish this, leading it to become exalted, while France's other linguistic varieties were denigrated. The two texts included here both take the form of exhortations on the part of the French government to French citizens to embrace the French language and dispense with their own tongues. In both, we can see examples of the three linguistic images mentioned previously. Firstly, dialectization is referred to by Calvinists and Scholar Pengus and Philipson as reserving the term language to refer to one or more chosen linguistic varieties, while using other terms to denote inferiority of any other variety spoken. And in these texts, we see the words such as idiome, jargon, and another text of this being the words patois, as you know. The latter of these explicitly suggesting corrupt speech. This corruption associated with this is reinforced by the use of deintellectualization or ruralization, which is used to strip away any positive attributions associated with these targeted varieties, and instead linking them to aggressiveness or incivility or even uncleanness. And here we see this in the use of the terms barbaric and vulgar, as well as links to the previous hated regimes of feudalism and slavery. And finally, although use of these languages was not made explicitly illegal as in other contexts, criminalization can be said to operate symbolically here, transferring the constructed negative images now to be associated with an individual now onto the speakers themselves. Speakers who continue to use these languages were to be seen as fanatics or counter-revolutionaries, and indeed their use of them was to be seen to identify them as an enemy. Speaking an inferior language, therefore, was to accept a meaning inferior oneself. I hesitate to show you this next slide because I haven't spoken to my dear colleague on it yet. There's some questions whether this first image is actually true or not, so I'm not entirely sure, but going on the basis that I believe it's true, we all know that the period of the Third French Republic for its ill treatment of the Rome Journal, and during this time that, as both you said, schools acted as agencies of linguistic coercion, and it was a time where these images of where this indexical link between being unclean, being inferior in some way was more explicitly passed on to pupils in schools. Don't have too much detail for this, so I'll move on to passive linguistic. The passive linguistic phase of France's history is characterized by discourse surrounding the Rome Légionnaire, which is markedly more positive, yet in which vocalizing and marginalizing images begin to become more apparent. Images which in combination portray these languages as ultimately possessing no use in modern societies. So for example, the sentence, the regional languages belong to the patrimony of France, was added to the French Constitution in 2008. Now there is no denying this is a profoundly positive statement and sentiment in a profoundly significant text which recognizes the contribution of these languages to the national cultural heritage. The image is certainly at least superficially positive. In spite of this, it could be argued that this phrase, and particularly its use to the exclusion of any statement granting specific rights to speakers in day-to-day life, might be seen as consigning these languages to the past, creating warm, fuzzy connections to one's heritage. And in John Joseph we like these languages, but we're not necessarily saying that you can use them in any particular purpose. If we compare this to the lines of the constitution related to French, we see the language of the Republic is French, and famous for what we see French is described as the fundamental element of the personality and patrimony of France. It's the language of teaching, work, trade, and public services. So here we see that the French language is established as the default language for most, or if not all, the means of French society. It is related to the patrimony of France, but it's also related to its inherent personality, its inherent character. And therefore, the combined with that vocalization, the image constructed of France's other linguistic varieties would appear to be one of marginalization, possessing their roots firmly in the past and serving the sole temporary purpose of facilitating one nostalgia for the way that things were rather than how they are. And while the current positive attitudes towards a minority language, which this superficially positive discourse would certainly provide, the lack of meaningful contemporary roles created for the language and a may reinforce the belief that this is the default or necessary or desired language, which may lead speakers to become unconvinced of the advantages of transmitting these languages and potential speakers of the benefits of investing in learning. I'm not going to go through this for too long, of course. There's just so much to say about this topic, I apologize. During my master's hours, absolute conclusion.